lessons of major war, and so on and so on. He's also achieved the rare honor for an academic of appearing on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, as well as many other television and radio appearances. So again, same ground rules, roughly 30 minutes or so. Please join me in welcoming back to UCLA, John Mueller.
Hey, nice to be here. I'd like to start my usual disclaimer. Everything I say is will be basically coming from me directly and should not be taken to indicate the views of Woody Hayes or of any of his football players, particularly the bigger ones. What I'd like to do is talk about three things. One really fits quite closely with what James Mann just been talking about, sort of the what I call policing wars ending with Iraq and Afghanistan. And indicate whether, you know, where that seemed to have come from and where it may be going. Then also the issue of terrorism and also the issue of policy toward proliferation, which I think are unlikely to change very much, somewhat regretfully. What seems to have happened at the end of the Cold War is that the great countries, the big countries, the developed countries, basically saw the world in the same way, roughly. When the Civil War broke out in Yugoslavia, they all thought this was a bad thing. They didn't necessarily know how to stop it or anything, but they thought it'd be nice if it could be stopped, and they were not exacerbating it. In the Cold War, what you would have had, presumably, was the Soviets supporting one side in the Civil War and the West supporting the other, and that was no longer the case. So there was a kind of a collegial situation in which everybody saw the world in many respects in a similar way, and so that what that did was leave them free, it seems to me, to use their military force, and as well diplomatic and other forces, to try to stop bad things. And there are two bad things that they seem to be willing to focus on, if not necessarily to always act with much speed on. One of these was trying to police civil wars, and the other was to try to get rid of bad regimes. Over the course of the 20th century, far more people have been killed by their own regime than have been killed by all the wars put together, international and civil. So that consequently, extremely bad regimes like North Korea in the 1990s, which essentially was incapable of handling a famine which may have killed 2 million people, or places like Rwanda, where the government essentially went on a genocide romp and killed at least 500,000 people. Those kinds of things have cost more lives than have wars, including. But you've got things like the Great Leap Forward of under Mao and the various collectivization under Stalin and obviously the Holocaust and so forth. At any rate, the idea was basically you've got some bad things going on in the world. We basically don't have to worry about fighting each other, and we're basically on that more or less the same page. So beginning basically in 1989 and continuing through Iraq and Afghanistan, there were a series of these kinds of interventions. Sometimes they were fairly collegial, such as sending the Australians into East Timor, or many troops into Somalia, or partially collegial, like the Kosovo intervention, or very substantially collegial, such as the first Gulf War, or basically fairly unilateral, like the American intervention to get rid of a thug, Noriega, from Panama. And most of these have been fairly successful up until Iraq, and now it looks like Afghanistan. And there's also a way out. Basically, if you got into one of these things, it was basically a humanitarian kind of situation, and if it failed, you just get out. That's what basically happened with Somalia. Clinton came up against a situation which seemed to be intractable, not all that much different from what happened in Iraq for Bush later, George W. Bush later. But he simply pulled the troops out, and the election came a few years later, and no one even remembered Somalia. So basically, there's no political cost long term to getting out. The same way that's happened before. The United States, of course, withdrew from Vietnam in 1975, and the election in 1976, the issue hardly even came up. And when it did come up, Gerald Ford took credit for it. He said, "When I came into office in 1974, we were still involved in a war in Southeast Asia. Now, no American is fighting anywhere in the world. Vote for me." In other words, he took credit for the greatest debacle in American foreign policy history. And I don't know if it helped with his votes, but it didn't hurt. And Carter, his opponent, didn't come out and say anything about it. He just went on to issues about foreign price supports or something like that. Similarly, a humanitarian event earlier when troops were sent into Lebanon by Reagan in 1983, some were blown up, and he pulled them out in 1984. He redeployed them to the sea. He didn't really pull them out. He redeployed them to the sea, and then the ship sort of bobbed away, and pretty soon they were in Charleston, South Carolina. But the election was just a few months later, and it didn't hurt him at all. So basically, on humanitarian ventures like that, you can withdraw and it is accepted. The problem would be sticking in too long and having a large number of Americans being killed. And it should be kept in mind, I mean, James Vann is very much right, I think, but the opposition party at various times was poised to destroy the administration if the venture went badly. If the first Gulf War in 1991 had gone badly, George H.W. Bush would have been annihilated by the Democrats who had been opposed to it, very strongly opposed to it, that we should rely on sanctions and so forth. It turned out the war was hugely successful, spectacularly so in its own terms, and the Democrats ceased to exist for about 6 months. They did finally come back and were still able to win the election in 1992 because the focus shifted very quickly from George Bush's wonderful venture in the Gulf to the disaster that the economy was undergoing. Bill Clinton sent troops into Bosnia in 1995, and had they gotten into a situation like Somalia, which was very much predicted, or a situation like Iraq, he would have been clobbered, annihilated by the Republicans, or he would have pulled out in time. And same thing with Kosovo. I think if Kosovo had gone badly, I think the Republicans in that case would have been very much on the warpath. At any rate, I'd just like to remind you that before in the election of 2000, peacekeeping and that kind of experiment, that kind of intervention, was not necessarily all that popular. And let me read you here a quotation from everybody's favorite president, George W. Bush, in his presidential debates of 2000. And maybe we're getting back, we call this the Bush Doctrine, and maybe we're coming back to it. If we're an arrogant nation, they'll resent us. If we're a humble nation, but strong, they'll welcome us. I just don't think it's the role of the United States to walk into a country and say, we do it this way. And therefore, so should you. I think we can help. I think the United States must be humble and must be proud and confident of our values, but humble in how we treat nations that are figuring out how to chart their own course. So that was Bush 2, I guess. Got Bush 1, HW, this is Bush 1, and then Bush 2, and then, of course, Bush 3 after 9/11. But before going to that, let me just add, what happened in the rupture presumably more or less took place with 9/11. I might remind you, just a few days after 9/11, George Bush, W. Bush, made a speech at the National Cathedral in which he said it was now our mission to rid the world of evil. That is not humble. So I looked to see if anybody, you know, such a ludicrous statement. I think some newspaper with someone would say, even if only a few days after 9/11, come on, George, get off it. But I couldn't find no newspaper anyplace in LexisNexis. I looked, you know, rid world evil Bush, and it got discussed, but it got discussed as if it were a serious statement. The only glimpse in the newspapers was the New Orleans Times-Picayune, which suggested that Bush perhaps overpromised. So anyway, Bush came in basically, after that point, the only other entity that's ever tried to rid the world of evil, of course, was God. He drowned everybody and everybody, and then just for this one ark load of people, and then Noah gets off, and it didn't work. It didn't work. It failed. Because Noah then invents wine, gets drunk, and it's a slippery slope, and you've got Las Vegas. So the point is that ultimately what happened in the situation was that God was not able to rid the world of evil. So Bush has tried trying to outdo both his fathers, his heavenly father by ridding the world of evil, and his earthly father by getting rid of Saddam Hussein. So basically, there was this massive change after that. Now, what happened, it seems to me, is that things went bad. Because if you look at it, you know, even Somali was a disaster, obviously, but or a fiasco, but it wasn't a painful one because you got out. You know, cut your losses and got out. And Clinton could have done that in Kosovo, and he certainly could have done it in Bosnia. In many respects, what the peacekeepers were saying was, we're going in and we're going to try to solve this problem, and if we get shot up too much, we're getting the hell out of there. That was the policy. And in other words, we're not willing to spend a lot of capital and particularly a lot of lives for it. But with the arrogant attack against Saddam Hussein and particularly the reaction to it afterwards, I think that things have changed. We may be moving back more closely to George Bush's humble foreign policy. We'll have to see. But I'm not sure what the next administration is going to do, but even McCain is talking about, I don't think he quite goes as far as use the word humble. That would you don't probably can't even spell that, but he does have a sense of trying to communicate more with the world community and so forth, and both Democrats are on that page as well. So I suspect there's going to be, I don't know if it's a rupture or a re-rupture, an anti-rupture or anything, but it's going to be a sort of toning down and a more willingness to cooperate. You're already seeing that actually with the Bush administration even now in many respects. I did an article in Foreign Affairs a few years ago called the Iraq Syndrome, and by writing it now, I might call it the Afghanistan Syndrome, that the disasters in both those countries, I think, have put a very bad image about peacekeeping. Is you get sucked into these things, which make things like policing in Cyprus, for example, look like child's play, obviously, and that's sort of a unpleasant experience in many respects. And so I think we're probably going to see a lot less of that in many respects, certainly this kind of occupation. If the United States leaves Iraq, I think the experience suggests that the American public will accept it in a heartbeat. Maybe several heartbeats, may take a while. But as they accepted defeat in Vietnam, which is a catastrophe, in any meaningful foreign policy terms, plus Somalia, Lebanon, seems to me they'll accept the same thing in Iraq, unless something comes out of Iraq which directly threatens the United States. After Iraq, I suspect also what's going to happen is that if the Americans do withdraw in some way or other, preferably within less than the 100-year timetable of Bill Clinton, then what will happen is that the neighbors in that area will actually try to help. Right now, most of the neighbors have been threatened by the Bush administration, by the neoconservatives and so forth, saying you're next, essentially. And so, therefore, if you're Iran, if you're the Palestinian Authority, if you are Egypt, if you are Libya, if you are Syria, what you really want to have happen is the Iraq experience be as miserable as possible for the United States, and so they won't try to affect you on that. But after the war is over, after the Americans are out, they would have a collegial interest in trying to keep the situation in Iraq under control, preferably pacified, but at least contained what more or less happened over the long civil war within Iraq, within Lebanon earlier. Okay, I'd be glad to come back to that, and we might want to talk about what will happen in the future on these things, but I think that may be a rupture or a change. The other two areas, terrorism and proliferation, I think I very much agree with James Mann, is very much a continuity situation. I don't see that much change. I think what's happened with terrorism is that it's become sort of built in, and it'll go, it'll go on forever. Let me give you a few quotes here. John McCain in his Boilerplate says that terrorism and Muslim extremism represents a transcendent challenge of the 21st century. The New York Times, not a big McCain supporter, says the fight against al-Qaeda is a central battle for this generation. And Michael Chertoff says that we are in a significant existential struggle. That's to differentiate it from various insignificant existential struggles we've had in the past. I think what's happening is that various things are going on. One is they can't find any terrorists, my book is called Overblown, and I might want to sort of revise that. If I wrote it again, I'd call it amazingly overblown. It just seems to me that the threat is out there and it's become internalized. And will be there forever, more or less like the threat that was once perceived from domestic communists in the United States. sort of the Korean War, and then before that, the Rosenberg atomic spy case and the Hiss-Chambers case, I think basically embedded, and even though people weren't paying attention to communism, domestic communism very much in the future, after those early episodes in the late 40s and early 50s, nonetheless, the anti-communist image and approach just simply continued. The FBI kept looking. So if you look in the LA Times this morning, or another article by the same guy last Friday, everybody's wondering why something's wrong with the FBI. They can't find any terrorists. And I emailed this morning the author of that, suggesting, doesn't anybody bring up the possibilities they can't find anything because there aren't anything to find? And he thought, yeah, that's an interesting point. Look into it, so that's good. He seems to be flexible. His father also went to Ohio State and played in the band, so therefore he has to pay attention to what I say. At any rate, what seems to be the terrorist threat, such as it is, the existential threat, is suggested to me by the following. Let me do this fairly quickly. But there's a new book out by a guy named Mark Sageman called Leaderless Jihad. And Sageman is a very well-known expert in this area at the University of Pennsylvania, former Foreign Service officer, and served time in Afghanistan. And what he says is that the terrorists, the Al-Qaeda, which is the only terrorist group that wants to get the United States, consists of the following three elements. A, terrorists left over from the golden 80s, which is when they were formed and fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. And this, he says, consists of a few dozen people. A few dozen people. They're running around, or hiding out, or digging holes, sharing tents with goats and well-thumbed Qurans, someplace in Pakistan or in Afghanistan. Then, in addition, he says there's about another 100 who are left over from the even more golden days for Al Qaeda, the 1990s. They're there too. These guys are dangerous; they might do something bad and so forth. But that's 150 people. Then he says there's a third wave, which is the sort of flakes around the world who are talking to each other over the internet and trying to dare each other to do something, but mostly nothing ever happens. A couple of weeks ago, Fawad Gurgis, another expert in this area, whose work I admire very much, who did a supremely good book called The Far Enemy a few years ago, was visiting Ohio State and had a lot of time to talk. And I asked him about Sageman's book, which he'd read. In fact, he had to read it because he's in the process of reviewing it for the Washington Post. And he says, well, those numbers are a little bit low. I'd say more like 200 or 300. And he also added another third wave. His third wave is not so much the internet generation of these guys trying to say, why don't you blow something up someplace? Okay, well, look, what do you do that with? I guess a bomb, that kind of thing. He says his concern a little bit is more in the Middle East, of an underclass of essentially illiterate types who might go to Iraq to fight against the Americans if they could ever get enough money to get there, sort of the festering lower class who can cause problems, but the problems are mostly going to be caused, he thinks, for the people in those countries, in Jordan or Syria or Turkey or Egypt or wherever they are. So that's basically, it seems to be, the extent of the threat, the supposedly existential threat to the United States. The idea that these characters can come up with nuclear weapons is to say the least, a massive stretch. There's also another issue, which is what has Al-Qaeda done since 9/11? And there's two lists of sort of every Muslim extremist terrorist attack since 9/11 outside of war zones, outside of like Iraq and Afghanistan. And one is published by the RAND Corporation out here in Santa Monica. The other was published by the CSIS, the think tank, Anthony Cordesman in Washington. So I just went through this list of all these attacks. It includes London and Bali and, all those things, Madrid and so forth. And it doesn't make for very pleasant reading. But I went through and sort of added up how many people have been killed, totally, by Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda wannabes, Al-Qaeda maybes, Al-Qaeda's, putative Al-Qaeda's, throughout the whole world outside of war zones. And it comes out to be something like 200 or 300 a year. Well, that's 200 or 300 a year too many, obviously, but it's smaller than the number of people who die drowning in bathtubs in the United States in a single year. Or if you want to use a more interesting comparison, a couple of economists at Cornell have calculated how many Americans die each year because they drive. What's happening is short-haul airplanes people don't take short-haul airplane flights anymore because of the increased cost and inconvenience. So consequently, they drive. Driving is more dangerous than flying, and their calculation are that over 400 Americans die every year because they drive rather than fly on short-haul flights, which means the Transportation Security Administration is responsible for more deaths since 9/11 than is Al-Qaeda. So that's the existential enemy, or the significant existential enemy. And I think people are, and also what's happening is that people are sort of are not spending much time thinking about terrorism any more than they used to spend all that much time thinking about domestic communists, particularly after the McCarthy period, after McCarthy was dead in the mid-50s. But I think it's just sort of built in that it's going to continue for a long time. That basically both parties, Democrats and Republicans, see the threat as a big one, and they're terrified politically of saying what I'm saying, because they'll be seen as being soft on terrorism, just like in the old days the Democrats were afraid of being seen soft on communism. During the whole Cold War, if there's somebody, we've got a bunch of historians here, so maybe people remember, as far as I know, no one ever said the following thing in print, as far as I can see. The domestic American Communist Party is basically subscribes to a foreign ideology. Some of them also would want to use violence to overthrow the government. They don't love capitalism. And they may also be anti-democratic and kind of dangerous in that sense, if you value those things. However, they're basically a pathetic bunch, and they couldn't subvert their way out of a wet paper bag. Now, I think that's basically true. It's arguable, obviously. But as far as I know, no one said that during the Cold War, ever, as far as I know, in print. Some may have thought it. But I don't know, and if you know anybody. Anyway, I think that may be happening now with terrorism, a similar sort of thing. Or the drug war. How can you come out against the drug war? Because obviously you must be in favor of drugs and all that kind of stuff. Even though the drug war is basically destroying Afghanistan, right? It's only a form of export. If drugs are legalized and they could export drugs the way Colombia exports coffee, the government probably could make a lot more money than it's getting from its well-wishers in the United States and in Western Europe, but it's an issue someone has to calculate. Okay, let me turn now to my final issue. So it seems to me this is going to continue on. Oh, yes, also basically, one more point on this, though I sort of already underlined it, is the incredible incapacity to find any terrorists in the United States. The FBI constantly says what I call basically I think therefore they are, which is Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, says this. What really bothers me is the things we're not seeing, and he's now sort of toned that down. But you still get this basically coming out that basically they must be there. We can't find them, but they are there, and it's an existential threat. They have not been able to find a single true Al Qaeda sleeper cell in the United States after octillion dollars spent. Searching. It's not only the FBI, but it's all the other agencies as well, the NSA and so forth. What they have found is basically a handful of possibly dangerous flakes. I think I have that. I did want to read one thing if I can find it here quickly. This is the it's not leaking. Here it is. This is the guy they arrested in Miami. This guy basically said, this is from the Washington Post, Batiste confided somewhat fantastically, the word somewhat fantastically is the following, that he wanted to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago, which would then fall into a nearby prison, freeing Muslim prisoners who had become the core of his Moorish army. With them, he would establish his own country. Okay. So that's I agree that is at least somewhat fantastic. Anyway, it's mostly people like this. Some of these guys are more dangerous than that. There's a guy in Rockford, Illinois, who purchased four hand grenades and two pistols. He couldn't afford the $100. The FBI informant wanted to charge him, but he came up with two used stereo speakers. If this had been real, he might have actually gone to the shopping mall in Rockford, Illinois, and shot some people. So it's very good he's in the slammer. But he doesn't represent an existential threat to the United States, to the state of Illinois, to the city of Rockford, Illinois, or to the shopping mall in Rockford, Illinois, as far as I can see. Okay, last point. The thing about proliferation seems to be also is embedded. The idea that if any country gets nuclear weapons, the world comes screechingly to a halt. And that's by both Democrats and Republicans. John McCain, of course, has said that the only thing worse than Iran getting nuclear weapons, the only thing worse than using military action against Iran would be Iran getting nuclear weapons. Hillary Clinton says we have to keep Iran from getting nuclear weapons at all costs, at all costs. And 500,000 lives? How many? What's happened is that I think nuclear weapons have mostly been not terribly important players in world events. I'm writing a book now called Atomic Obsession, in which I try to deal with that sort of historically and contemporaneously. They basically haven't done anybody any good. I mean, it didn't help the Soviets when they were the Chinese when they were attacking North Vietnam. Didn't help the Soviets in Afghanistan. Aren't helping the United States, obviously, in Iraq or Afghanistan. Didn't help in Vietnam. Didn't help the French in Algeria. Didn't help the British at Suez, etc. So it's not clear they're very helpful. They're kind of a waste of money, mostly. But mostly what countries do when they get them is to use them to deter or for prestige or something. And that's probably likely to happen also with Iran, as well as that. I mean, I'd be very happy if Iran doesn't get the weapon and so forth, and North Korea. My concern, similarly, but my concern basically on this is that the efforts to stop proliferation are frequently more costly than what the proliferators are likely to do. During the Clinton administration, starting with the first Bush administration, and continued blandly by the Clinton administration. Was a effort to enforce sanctions on Iraq, which is killing lots of people. There are constant reports, press reports, official reports, reports in Lancet, special demography reports. They differed in their numbers, but they generally come out with well into six figures of people, particularly children under the age of five, who are dying because of the sanctions. It was a necessary cause of their deaths. It wasn't the complete cause. Saddam Hussein was also playing the game, and there's other problems. But the sanctions were a necessary cause. These people would not have died if the sanctions hadn't been there in the six figures. In the middle 1950s, the 1990s, Madeleine Albright appeared on 60 Minutes, was asked, we hear that 500,000 children have died in Iraq because of the sanctions. That's more than died at Hiroshima. I mean, that number is almost certainly too high, but anyway, that's what they asked her. Do you think it's worth it? And Madeleine Albright said, yes, well, it's very hard for me to say because I'm a humane person, but it has been worth it. The secretary, she at that time was not Secretary of State. Later, she was promoted to Secretary of State. At that time, she was head of United Nations ambassador for the United States, appearing on television, 60 Minutes, not exactly an obscure show, saying that, well, we killed 500,000. She didn't dispute the number either, though she could have. We killed 500,000 people. We're responsible for the deaths of 500,000 children in Iraq, and it's been worth it. I also checked that. See, anybody picked that up anywhere on television, newspapers? Nobody did. They didn't get any picked up. It did get picked up by Osama bin Laden. It did get picked up all throughout the Middle East. But basically, the sort of effort that because we got to stop Saddam Hussein from getting nuclear weapons, any price is willing to pay, particularly if it's only merely Iraqi, apparently, Iraqis or something. But the point is, during that whole period of time, that was almost never examined. By churches, though there are a few cases where the Pope was against it and stuff like that, but it never got very far, and obviously never got into the political arena. If it is a few hundred thousand, that's more than the number of people who died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. In fact, it may be more than died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all the people who died during World War I from gas combined. In other words, all the weapons of mass destruction. Killed by weapons, not in gas chambers. That's a different issue, obviously. With weapons in the history of the human race, more people were killed. The next step basically is the war in Iraq, which is more than anything else an anti-proliferation war. We can't let Saddam Hussein get nuclear weapons because if he does, he's going to do something or other. For example, he'll dominate the Middle East. And no one ever looks into that connection, Democrats or Republicans. How does he dominate the Middle East if he's got nuclear weapons? He says to Saudi Arabia, if you don't do what I do, I'm going to bomb you with my two or three atomic bombs when I'm surrounded by a coalition that has thousands of them. If you don't, change the price of oil or something. I mean, basically the whole idea that somehow they would dominate the Middle East repeated endlessly by both parties, most recently, of course, mainly by the Republicans, Condoleezza Rice and so forth, they were basically examined. And the idea that he'd keep them because he's being constantly threatened by the United States, which he obviously was during the 1990s, is not particularly brought up very much. Okay, we still get that, and let me just conclude with two other things related to this. One is North Korea. Graham Allison has written this book called Nuclear Terrorism, and he says one of the main things should happen would be that North Korea should not be allowed to get nuclear weapons. And if we do so, we have to do everything possible to get them, stop them from getting it, these diplomatic measures, economic measures, and so forth. But if push comes to shove, we should basically start a war. A war in Korea would cost maybe 80,000 lives. There are many calculations that are much higher than that. And so he's willing to accept that. We should kill 80,000, mostly Koreans, of course, in order to keep North Korea, this basket case, pathetic, ridiculous country, from being able to have the occasional nuclear weapon. Now, presumably, they more or less have them, and presumably Allison and other people, in fact, virtually the whole Washington establishment would be on his page, presumably is willing to go to war if they follow what they've been saying with North Korea, though that has been somewhat backburnered now. The final issue, basically, obviously, is with Iran, and you get the same kind of flaky, it seems to me flaky, I'm being judgmental here, sorry, argument. Let me give you an example from a friend of mine, Joe Cirincione, who's at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. He's got an article in National Interest a couple of months ago, and he says, okay, he is not in favor, as far as I know, of bombing Iran to keep it again from nuclear weapons. But he says the following. One, if Iran gets nuclear weapons, they will not give them to anybody else, like terrorists, like Hezbollah, because you could trace it and so forth. And if Hezbollah dropped an atomic bomb someplace, Israel has a fair number of things with which to retaliate. And because of nuclear forensics, you can tell where a bomb came from, and that would not be good news for the Iranians. And they know that. So he's not worried about that. The other is, he says, they wouldn't use them. In the Middle East, they just keep them, you know, for prestige or for being able to swing their weight a little bit if it insofar as it works. So he's not worried about that they'd actually use them. But what he does say is that if Iran gets nuclear weapons, then a bunch of other countries in the area would want to get nuclear weapons. And then the fourth point is that is a recipe for nuclear war. End of argument. Okay, well, I mean, then the issue is, okay, if you really think that's a recipe for nuclear war, obvious, even though Cirincione is not in favor of even, as far as I know, even bombing Iran, much less invading, if you believe that, it's an extremely good argument for starting a war against Iran. Because even if they don't use them, even if they don't give them to terrorists, if they do something which is, quote, a recipe for nuclear war in the Middle East, obviously a conventional war in the Middle East will be much, much better than a nuclear war, so we ought to go for it. So it seems to me that in terms of terrorism and in terms of this non-proliferation obsession, it seems to me that we've got a great deal of continuity going back to the Bush period. And on the other hand, it seems to me in many respects the policing war idea is faded away back, and we may be coming closer to the way Bush was expressing it in 2000, in the election 2000, namely trying to move toward a more humble foreign policy. It's hard to imagine one that wouldn't be more humble than one we've had, but at least there's maybe some change in that direction. Okay, thanks.
Thanks.